on the bills, we're gonna start out with House Bill 3446. Mr. Devlin, Representative Devlin.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, I am State Representative Richard Devlin from Lake Oswego and Tualatin. I thank the committee for hearing this bill. I believe that there is a great need to address sex offender treatment in Oregon. House Bill 3446 begins to address this need. Unfortunately, House Bill 3446 was not written as I had originally intended. Legislative Council has prepared Dash 1 amendments that better reflects the intent behind House Bill 3446. As I have proposed amending this bill, it would direct the Department of Corrections in consultation with the Superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital to conduct a study concerning the feasibility of establishing a sex offender treatment pilot program within one of our adult male correctional facilities. I believe very strongly that this bill is important because we know that virtually every sex offender sentenced under Measure 11 will be released someday. Changes in Oregon law in 1999 established enhanced sentencing for persons found to be sexually violent, dangerous offenders. Under the 1999 law, this type of offender is subjected to lifetime post-prison supervision, which allows an offender to be returned to custody for up to 6 months for each post-prison supervision violation. While this law is an improvement over previous laws regarding release of sex offenders, it does not address treatment. Currently, Oregon does not require or provide any institutional treatment for sex offenders, even though these offenders ultimately will be released into our communities. We know that there is a high recidivism rate for sex offenders, but the treatment for those who could benefit from it could mean fewer victims down the road. Unfortunately, not providing treatment at the beginning of incarceration increases the chance of more severe criminal behavior being learned while the offender is incarcerated, thereby decreasing amenability to treatment later. Research has shown that there is a subgroup of sex offenders who are amenable to and benefit from treatment that is targeted specifically at their offending behaviors, psychological characteristics, and social environment. This bill would consider whether or not we could implement a pilot program at an existing adult male institution to determine if recidivism could be reduced through institutional treatment. A study of a possible pilot program would include assessment of sex offenders to identify those who would most likely benefit from treatment, certain factors such as age, other criminal activities, use of weapons in committing sexual offenses, support systems in the community, and motivation to seek treatment might be considered. A narrow range of treatment alternatives in a residential setting for a period of 18 to 24 months and continued long-term supervision and treatment for a sex offender participating in the program would also be considered. The measure anticipates treatment eventually occurring during an offender's period of incarceration, but it does not anticipate that this bill would lead to any reduction in the offender's sentence. Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony. If I might speak just extemporaneously here for a moment and let you know why this bill came forward. I, like many of you, have been through the circumstance of sex offenders that are being placed on parole, being placed in their communities. I'm actually one of the sponsors for one of the bills that are in this building right now in terms of where they should be located within communities in terms of distances from children, et cetera. During these times when we considered this in my communities, one of the things that was done is we started to look at what was actually available inside the institutions. And I was already aware, having been a former Department of Corrections employee, that most of our programs were in the process, even when I was there, of being eliminated, and they all are eliminated at this point. However, what I saw was a clear possibility by looking at some of our new institutions, particularly institutions that are new pod facilities where inmates are basically within a pod and about only 92, 93 inmates are within that pod. Those provide a physical situation in which inmates can be separated from other inmates. In talking to Dr. Mazerhart, the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, he identified being able to separate sex offenders from other offenders within the institution as being a major factor in trying to put together a program, because if you, as long as you kept them in the general population, the effectiveness of treatment would be somewhat limited. But our new facilities, which are in pod arrangements with about 92, 93 inmates per pod, that's the number in Umatilla, I don't know what the number is in Ontario, would make it possible to put this kind of program into effect. Now, I clearly know that there is a cost to actually putting together an actual pilot program, and I know that in our current budget crisis, the chances of getting an actual pilot program funded are limited to none. That's why I've actually asked there be a study to identify what the cost of a pilot program would be, what the benefits of it would be, and to bring that back to the next legislative session. Clearly, the reason for that is that this is an unanswered question that will come back again and again to the legislature. Clearly, I favor the stronger sentences, longer sentences that have been provided for sex offenders, but I recognize, too, that those offenders will ultimately be released back to the community, and anything we can do to diminish the rate of recidivism for sex offenders is probably of long-term benefit to all of us and all Oregonians. With that, thank you for hearing my testimony, and the Department of Corrections will come forward and indicate that they are supportive generally of the bill. More than generally, they're supportive of the bill. They would like some changes in language, even to the -1 amendments. So we will be coming back later with those changes, and we're hopeful that this will be approved by the committee, and we know that it'll probably end up with a fiscal well below the $50,000, so it shouldn't have to go to Ways and Means.
Committee members, do you have any questions?
I do, Chair.
Mr. Chair,
I have a question for Representative Devlin. In regards to why the original programs were eliminated, could you give a little bit of background on that? Was it due to cost? Was it due that there were studies done that showed that they weren't effective?
Well, I think the officials here from the Department of Corrections could probably give a more complete answer, but the very direct answer is cost. Okay. When they had to make the choices between incarcerating more offenders or providing treatment, the direction of the public was to incarcerate more offenders. So most treatment programs like this have been cut from the institutions.
Thank you.
Further questions? I have just maybe one here. It indicates 18 to 24 months of treatment. Many of those sentences are much, much longer than that when in the prison. When would you envision they would receive that treatment, just prior to release?
Mr. Chairman, in discussing this with Dr. Mazerhart, the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, I think that's part of the question that the study will try to answer, because particularly if a person has been sentenced consecutively to some of the Measure 11 sentences, they may be doing 20, 30 years time. I think there has to be some determination of when it would be the most beneficial time to do that. Now, clearly, there will be some singular offenses under Measure 11. Probably also there would be some correlation to offenders that are more amenable, because they would be somewhat less in terms of number of offenses, who might be only serving 7 to 8 years. Those might be more probably the people identified. If I could comment just briefly, I used to work in adult corrections a long time ago, and I used to actually work in one unit where there were quite a number of sex offenders within that unit. And they varied widely from a 17-year-old young man who had been tried as an adult. I think he was 18 by the time he came into the institution. Did a very serious crime, very serious offense. I always felt that if there might be a possibility of turning him around, but at the other end of the spectrum, I also had about a 58-year-old sex offender, pedophile, that had literally since the time he was about 10 years old had only had about 5 years outside of institutions, and literally had offended literally every 4 or 5 years after. He was incarcerated 4 or 5 years at a time and had literally reoffended within 6 months or a year. I'm no expert. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or even that much of an expert in this area of criminology. But that probable offender probably is not the type that would be amenable to treatment. The young man might have been. The 58-year-old who had caused a travesty all of his life probably would not be.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you, Representative Devlin.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 3446. We'll be back to it a little bit later on. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 3680. Representative Devlin? Doyle, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Dan Doyle, State Representative, House District 30. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3680, which relates to evidence of other acts of domestic violence. Basically, this bill allows the introduction of evidence that a defendant has committed other acts of domestic violence if that defendant is charged with the commission of offense involving domestic violence. Currently, under the Oregon Evidence Code, evidence of a history of abusive behavior is not admissible in cases involving domestic violence, and this bill corrects the oversight in that code that ensures that past abuses count towards the conviction of current domestic violence offenders. A couple of examples of why we need this bill, and these were just some examples taken from public record. I'm not going to use names, but to give you some insight here. There's one 48-year-old male a few years back, or just this last year, who had a criminal record and a lengthy history of domestic violence. Officers had responded to 16 domestic disturbances between 1992 and 1996. On June 4, 2000, he murdered his wife in front of sheriff's deputies, and then turned his gun on them, and he was then shot dead. Another individual, 43 years old, he was arrested for stalking his estranged wife. It appears that she was granted a restraining order against him, and this individual shot, killed his wife, and then later killed himself. Finally, another individual, 36 years old, male, his wife had complained to police about her husband's abusive behavior, received a restraining order, and then just 21 days later, he murdered his wife by shooting her. These are the kind of examples that when you see individuals coming up for trial, that basically the evidence code does not allow that kind of behavior to be admitted into evidence. And very simply, this bill would allow that to happen. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any members, do you have any questions? But they're going to let you off easy.
Appreciate that, and I urge your support. Thank
you. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3680 for now. We'll open it in a few minutes. And we're going to go to 3035, open a public hearing. And Representative Partridge, Patridge, we can get in trouble doing that.
I'm getting used to it by now, Mr.
Representative,
Chair.
I'll bring you a pear tree if that helps.
Thank you. My bus and the band are out in the parking lot. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to bring you today House Bill 3035 and 3059, and House Bill 3059. I know we've just opened the hearing on House Bill 3035. Mr. Chair, these bills are interrelated, and they were both made at the request of the Kelly family. The Kelly family is here today and has signed up to testify in regard to these bills. They can share with you the tragic story that brought about these particular pieces of legislation in their lives. In sum, their child, Tommy Kelly, who was a minor, was injected with methamphetamine, had some kind of meth psychosis or some other piece, ran away from a particular situation he was in where other people were carrying on a party and this activity was going on. He was injected by an adult. He ran away. Tragically, he died. The circumstances surrounding his death, his body was not recovered for a period of a year. That is tragic, for the Kelly family and what happened, unfortunately, in Jackson County. As many of you know, I was a former drug prosecutor in Jackson County. I spent the last 2 years of my tenure in the district attorney's office prosecuting drug crimes. I bring you House Bill 3035 today because of something that I see as a need in the law that is not properly punished and also is not specific in the law. House Bill 3035 would provide a crime if a person unlawfully administers, either by injection, inhalation, or ingestion, if they provide, if someone does that to a minor. Specifically in this case, he was injected by an adult. We know that heroin becomes a more and more popular drug. We also know that methamphetamine is oftentimes mixed in a spoon, which is heated up. It is then mixed with water, and it is injected. And that's how many people take methamphetamine. That's the situation that happened to Tommy Kelly. In reviewing the statutes, based upon my experience in criminal law, while you could charge a delivery, it is arguable whether a delivery can take place. In the situation that Mr. Kelly was involved with, the person who injected him with methamphetamine, I don't know if the committee previously went over the sentencing guidelines. I borrowed these from Mr. Taylor because I didn't have an updated copy, but he was charged with a crime category 8, delivery of a controlled substance to a minor. Fortunately, this person had prior convictions, prior felony convictions, but the most that a judge would order in that particular case under our sentencing guidelines in Oregon was 27 to 28 months. This gentleman did receive 27 months. Colleagues, what I've asked is, in the administration of a controlled substance, it only provides, and people have raised this concern, so I will preempt the question and address that question being, people who are authorized, like doctors, nurses, and other, to apply a controlled substance or other items like people who are diabetic would not be covered by this bill. This deals with specifically controlled substances. Those other people, the administration of those substances, they're authorized in other areas of the statute to give. This specifically is intended to deal with drug cases, and I don't believe has unintended consequences. We tried to address those within the definitional parameters of the bill. This would make injecting a controlled substance to a minor a crime category 9. Similar items that are a crime category 9 within the statutes are, if a burglary is committed, and if the person is either armed with a deadly weapon or caused or threatened to cause physical injury to a victim, that's in a burglary case. Also, in an arson case, I believe that there was an arson, but with $50,000 or more and no threat of serious physical injury is a crime category 9 under the sentencing guidelines in Oregon. I think this is more than appropriate. It is an intentional act that someone knows they are doing. This was intended to be an adult on a juvenile. The only other thing I would offer up to the committee was the committee in working this bill may want to make it that there's at least 3 years of separation between the adult and the youth. But this was intended to be a strict liability crime, that if they gave items to a youth, that they would be subject to crime category 9. Crime category 9 under the Oregon Revised Statutes, under our sentencing guidelines, provide at the low end, if the person has no prior conviction, 34 to 36 months, and if the person is at the top of the grid with 3 or more person felonies, they would receive 66 to 72 months. Currently, under the current law, a person could receive optional probation and have no incarceration or jail time whatsoever. I think that the Kelly family instance is not the only instance I saw in my experience as a drug prosecutor in Jackson County. I have tried not to make this a Measure 11 type of crime, specifically in talking to members of the legislature and in talking to others in the criminal justice field, but I do feel this type of crime as a crime category 9 is more than appropriate. It's almost as bad as playing Russian roulette with a juvenile. In my opinion, when you're injecting or administering illegal controlled substances to a juvenile. These people are scared enough as it is. Let's not help them get over the edge by shooting up for them. That's why I brought this particular bill forward, and I appreciate the consideration of this committee. You will hear from the Kelly family in just momentarily.
Okay, Representative Pastor, why don't you have them come up, the Kelly family?
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Victoria Kelly.
Thomas Kelly.
Mr. Chair, for the record, could we open up House Bill 3059 at the same time? Their testimony is very interrelated between the two bills, if that's appropriate. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Oregon legislatures, a missing child is every parent's worst nightmare. Every 40 seconds, a child is reported missing in America. Unfortunately, it can happen anywhere, anytime. This became our family's reality January 26, 1999, when our 17-year-old son, Tommy, disappeared. Every day, 2,200 children are reported missing in America. The Justice Department yearly statistics are 438,200 accounted children who are lost, missing, and injured. 354,000 children are abducted by family members. 114,600 attempted abductions by non-family members. 300 abductions by non-family members where children are gone for long periods of time or the child was murdered. There are another 450,700 runaway children. Runaways are children who are categorized as children who leave home voluntarily without the knowledge or permission of their parents or their guardians, who stay away at least overnight. Any child missing is a child at risk. The Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention estimates that 127,100 children are thrown away children, children abandoned or kicked out of their parents' home. The total number of children in all cases is 1,484,900 children yearly. These numbers are totally inconceivable, but sadly true. Most children return home or are recovered safely. This is because law enforcement is reporting with greater seriousness and professionalism than ever before, yet several thousand cases are not resolved. It is imperative that law enforcement receive training on how to respond when a child is missing. When you get on a plane, you assume the pilot knows how to fly the plane and has received training in how to respond to an emergency. When a parent calls 911 to report a missing child, they should feel assured that law enforcement has received training in how to respond to a child who is missing, and unfortunately, this is not always the case. Our children are our most cherished treasures, and it should be our utmost priority to assure their recovery. I'm here before you today to encourage you to pass a law that will ensure training for law enforcement. National Missing and Exploited Children offers this training free to law enforcement. They will pay for transportation, lodging, two meals a day at the National Center in Arlington, Virginia. This eliminates any expenditures to the taxpayers. Time is critical when a child is missing. Law enforcement must have training on the FBI protocol for missing children cases. They must be informed about listing a child with descriptive information on the NCIC computer. The 1999 Federal Child Search Assistance Act made it mandatory that police immediately take a report and enter the case into the NCIC computer. This does not always happen. Also, this creates better coordination between law enforcement and the FBI for greater consistency on crimes against children. This will help identify how many children are missing. Law enforcement must have the knowledge of the available resources, such as Project Alert, a free service of retired law enforcement officers specifically trained in missing children's cases, who come to communities where manpower may be low to devote the time necessary to recover a missing child. Not all law enforcement agencies are aware of the services available for help. Law enforcement officers must be given the tools to fulfill their oath to protect and to serve. The legacy of America's missing children can be seen in new laws and in improved responses from law enforcement. Enormous progress has been made to better protect our nation's children, but a great deal needs to be done. It could be anyone's child that is reported missing. It could be yours. One child missing is one too many. Our son Tommy was listed as missing and endangered for a year and a half. Last June 2000, his skeletal remains were found in 30-foot-high by 20-foot blackberry bushes. It is believed that he died from a drug overdose, methamphetamine, supplied by a 34-year-old woman and administered to him by a 29-year-old man. My son made the poor choice to become involved with drugs, and he paid the ultimate price. But he was a minor who had his whole life ahead of him. He could have been anyone's child. The people responsible pled guilty to delivery of a controlled substance to a minor, delivery by tying off Tommy's arm. They didn't load bullets into a gun, but loaded methamphetamine into a syringe. They didn't pull a trigger, but pushed the plunger on the rig and shot him full of poison. Meth does kill. There are no laws on the books that would have made them accountable for our son's death. Instead, the woman received a 30-day sentence, a slap on the hand for her responsibility in our son's death. The man who did the injecting received a 2.5-year sentence, of which he may do a year and a half. My son received a death sentence, and our family received a lifelong sentence of having to face the perpetrators in our community. Where is the justice in that? A person who abuses an animal faces tougher sentencing, and these are our children of which we are speaking. Teenagers sometimes have poor decision-making skills. As adults, it is our responsibility to attempt to make laws for their protection. I encourage you to pass House Bill 3035, which creates involuntary drug administration to a minor, a Class A felony, with a prison sentence of 34 to 72 months. Thank you for your time and consideration, the Kelly family.
Mr. Kelly, are you going to testify? Okay, the committee members, do you have any questions for the Kelly family or Representative Partridge?
I just wanted to present, we have the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3059. DPSST has reviewed those. Diamond was here earlier, and I believe there is someone from DPSST. They are comfortable with these amendments, which do, Bill, I think we've sent those up to the, they're the Dash 1 amendments. I believe we've forwarded them on.
I don't have them here.
Okay. Well, I will give them. I'll just leave this with Mr. Taylor.
Can you explain?
The Dash 1 amendments provide that the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training shall ensure that all police officers and certified reserve officers are trained to investigate and report cases of missing children. When federal training programs are made available to the state at no cost to the state, the Board shall offer the training to police officers and certified reserve officers. DPSST is comfortable with the language, and is a representative from DPSST is here to testify to that fact. This will ensure that some of the complications surrounding missing children are solved, and that we will have trained police officers in the field that can help deal with these issues. They attempt to do that now. This will strengthen their resolve to make sure that officers are trained in the state of Oregon and make the federal programs available. There's no fiscal impact on this amendment, is my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. You have a question?
I'm so sorry for what happened to your son. How wrong, just simply wrong that is. I am concerned about the fiscal, though. You say that there is no fiscal, but this is going to result in... how did you come to the conclusion that there was no fiscal?
Regarding the fiscal on the training portion, on the training bill or the...
increased incarceration.
The increased incarceration, I don't mean to mislead the committee. I was talking about the training piece.
Uh-huh.
Regarding the incarceration piece, this will, I don't know if we've gotten a fiscal on that. I don't imagine that will be a lot. If so, then you need to send it to Ways and Means. I'll advocate for it in the Ways and Means process. I think that it is a problem that does not occur often, but when it does occur and tragedies occur,
yeah,
it is very unfortunate. And I also want to say for the record that I admire the Kelly family. Oftentimes families who deal with the criminal justice system and deal with the frustration oftentimes go away and are bitter about government and the system. They've chosen to step up and have a legacy for their family. have requested these on behalf of their son. They have tried to turn this into something good that will benefit the rest of our children in society, and that's why I'd ask for your support of this.
Any further questions?
Follow-up, please. Okay. I agree with you. Probably this is not going to have any kind of a fiscal because it's not going to happen all that often. But when it does, there really should be some serious consequences, and I agree with you that, and thank you for turning this tragedy into something positive.
Mr. Chair? Representative Shetterly.
Well, thank you, Representative Patridge. I was just looking, can you tell me again, why was this not prosecuted as, well, I'm looking here at 475-995.
I don't have the statute.
Okay, it's distribution of a controlled substance to a minor. Delivery.
A delivery of a controlled substance to a minor is a crime category 8. If you'll look at the, let me give you the.
If you'll look at the sentence.
Crime category 8 offense. A crime category 8 offense under Oregon law starts out with optional probation, meaning that they could just be put on probation and have to serve. No time. They could be incarcerated in a local, at a local facility and not be subject to going to the state penitentiary. I think that this is a pretty heinous crime. And when I tried to compare it to a burglary or an arson crime, I think it's almost the equivalent, though couldn't be prosecuted, as some of the major assaults that are currently authorized under Measure 11, but wouldn't rise to that level. Because of the fact that many people inject methamphetamine and many people, you know, and most people survive the injection of methamphetamine and other crimes. And I think it would be, as a prosecutor, almost impossible to prove. That's why we chose to do it this way.
Are there further questions by the committee?
We have the Dash 1 amendments in front of us. Is there any questions for Representative Patridge about the Dash 1 amendments? Okay.
I just want to make a
Representative statement. Vicki Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. and Mrs. Kelly, I just want to thank you for coming today. I know I can't imagine what it's like to lose a child, but what you are doing today is really helpful for all of the other children out there. Your advocacy is to be admired. So thank you for coming. I'm not sure these will come out the way that you want them to, but we're going to work very hard on both of these bills, and I just want to thank you for being here.
Not that the legislature is addressing the issue, realizing that it is a national tragedy. The statistics are just most children do return home, but there are thousands of cases that have not been solved.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming and sharing your story with us today. Thank you, Representative Patridge. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3059. Representative Patridge, you had mentioned another bill which we had opened the hearing on. Do you wish to address that now?
House Bill 3059 and then House Bill 3035
right.
is the other bill, Mr. Chair. I believe that I was contacted yesterday by the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I know that they would like to testify in regarding this particular bill.
On
3035, I believe that they want to testify. Unless somebody signed up on 3059, I'm not.
Like a tap tap.
I'm not sure about that particular piece. And then I gave Mr. Taylor a note in regard to 3903.
We have some other people signed up who want to testify on 3903.
On which one?
On 3903.
And, Mr. Chair, I gave Mr. Taylor a note because you were out of the room.
Right.
I'd request that you tap that bill in and out, and I'm happy to work with, and I have informed Dave Fidanke as well about this bill and some of the people who want to testify. I'd rather work with them to see if we can bring something forward rather than waste the committee's time. I'd ask you to tap it in and out. If we can't reach some kind of agreement, then I'm not going to pursue it.
Okay. Thank you. And that's what we'll likely do on that bill. Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, colleagues, we will
open a work session on House Bill 3059. We have the Dash One amendments in front of us that that Representative Patridge has explained. Is there any further committee discussion about the amendments to this bill or about the bill in general?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Nobody signed up to testify? Nobody else?
No, I don't believe there were any other witnesses signed up to testify.
I'll move the Dash One.
Representative Vicki Walker moves the Dash One amendments to House Bill 3059. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the Dash Ones are adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3059 as amended to the full committee with a due House recommendation.
Representative Vicki Walker moves House Bill 3059 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? Is there any objection? The bill will move to the full committee. Representative Vicki Walker, will you carry the bill to the full committee?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Do the tap in, tap out. Okay, I'm going to open the hearing on House Bill 3903.
I don't have the sign-up sheet. Representative Patridge has simply requested that these folks have a chance to sit down with him and talk about this bill as opposed to using the committee's time to hear testimony on the bill. Looking at the list, they're all familiar to us. It's Ms. Botkin, Nick Arminicus from the Department of Corrections, and David Fedenke, fairly regulars in the building, so not people who are unaccustomed to being here. Based on that, I'll honor Representative Patrick's request and close the public hearing on House Bill 3903 and encourage you all to get together and chat about this bill before it comes back for committee action. Okay, I apologize, committee. I was speaking to a group in Portland, so it took me a little longer to get down here this morning, so I'm sort of playing catch-up, trying to figure out where you've been already. We're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3680, and at this point I would ask Gina Skinner from the Oregon District Attorneys Association and Kathleen Orr to come forward. Welcome. I'm glad you finally have an opportunity to testify on this bill.
I am as well, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for any inconvenience that we put on you by pushing our way to the front of the line here. But we feel that this bill, 3680, is very important. Again, my name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I specialize in prosecuting domestic violence crimes, and I have for several years now. As this committee is probably well aware and has heard testimony in other bills, domestic violence crimes are extremely difficult to prosecute. Domestic violence is not a one-time incident. It's usually a lifelong pattern with an abuser. And unfortunately, it takes women usually anywhere from 5 to 10 times of abuse before they're even willing to come forward and tell anyone about it or to call the police. And unfortunately, when I prosecute these crimes, the majority of the time, the victims of domestic violence are unwilling at that time to prosecute, and we're forced to go forward and prosecute those cases without them. And so, therefore, it is important that a jury or a judge gets to hear all the information about the abuser to make a rational and honest decision about the guilt of the defendant. As far as the law goes, currently under Oregon Evidence Code Rule 404, that talks about character evidence. The current law is that evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible in Oregon to prove the character of a person. It only is admissible for other purposes, such as a proof of motive, opportunity, intent, preparation, plan, knowledge, identity, or absence of mistake or accident. Those are the only ways you can get in other crimes or bad acts in Oregon. There was a case called State v. Johns that came out several years ago, a domestic violence case where a man had murdered his wife with a gun. And the prosecutor in that case was able to convince the court that a prior incident where he had threatened his prior wife with a gun should be admissible. And so there are some instances currently, if the state files a motion with the court, brings in witnesses and evidence, that under some very, very limited circumstances, we are able to bring in these prior bad acts currently here in Oregon. However, it is not, the judge and the jury are instructed that they are not allowed to use that evidence to basically look at the person's character or their propensity to commit this crime. And that, quite frankly, when you're talking about domestic violence, that's what it's about. It's a repetitive act that occurs for years and years. In California, in January of 1997, they passed a similar statute to the one that we're asking this committee to approve here. And I'm just going to just briefly read this bit that in a news article it talks about it, and it says, in practical terms, that this law in California permits courts to admit evidence of a defendant's other acts of domestic violence on a common sense basis with no precondition of finding a non-character purpose, like I've just described, for which it is relevant. The evidence will be subject to rational assessment by juries, including consideration of its bearing on the defendant's propensity to engage in domestic violence and the improbability that the defendant has been falsely or mistakenly accused of such offense. In California, as is this bill in Oregon, it would still be subject to what's called a 401-403 balancing test, which means that the judge would look at whether the evidence is relevant and would look at whether it's too prejudicial or causes too much delay or confusion. That test will still occur. And so if it meets any of those things, if it's too prejudicial or if it's too confusing or if it's not relevant at all, the judge won't let that evidence in. The difference is it will be allowed in to look at the propensity of the crime. And I brought with me today Kathleen Orr. She is a victim of domestic violence, or at least was until very recently, and just to talk to this committee about why it is that we would want to bring in this evidence. Not only are we talking about prior times where people have been convicted, but more specifically, prior times where it was never reported, or it was reported but it was never pursued, or it was reported and then when the police showed up, the victim said nothing happened. Why is it that that happens for years and years and years? But ultimately, when the victim is ready to get out of that relationship, as a system, we need to be there to help them to catch that victim and to be able to prosecute the batterer for everything that they've done to that victim and take into consideration all of those other acts as part of what happened.
Hey, Chairman Williams and members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Orr, and I've been a victim of domestic violence for 9 years. And that is the whole of my marriage. I was married for 9 years, and he did at least 42 different things to me in those 9 years. And that does include torture to my cat. He felt that I cared more for my cat than him, so he would torture that cat in front of me. He's also choked me. He's shot me. Held knives to my throat, guns to my head, and that's only to name a few. And in 1995, he did shoot me with a 20-gauge shotgun, and he took me to the hospital, and on our way to the hospital, he said, we're going to have to say something to them. So he said, well, let's make up a story. And so we told them that it was an accident, and that one of us forgot to unload the gun after grouse hunting. And I was sitting in the hospital room, knowing what really happened, and weighing the option of stating the truth or stating what he wanted me to say. And so I decided to keep the peace and tell what he told me to say, which for 5 years after that, it bothered me a great deal, until recently when a police officer at the state hospital asked me, Has there been any other incidences that you could tell us about? And I mentioned about the gun incident and told him what really happened. And so they investigated it more. And in May of 2000, I left my husband because he woke me up about 4:30 in the morning and slapped me with a washcloth, beat me with a motorcycle boot, and whipped me with a chain. And that was, the incident lasted, everything lasted for about an hour and a half. When he fell asleep, I took my kids to the bus stop, told them that I was going to leave their dad, that I would be getting them from school. And so I did that, left about 7:30, and went to Salem to the Women's Crisis Center. But first I had to go to the hospital because of the injury to my hip because of the motorcycle boot. But when we were at the trial in January, I could not speak of the other incidences, but only with what was reported, those five incidences on May 11th. And his defense was he was drunk and he didn't know what he was doing, which I could tell you many different times he was sober that he beat me and that it was out of sheer meanness. And I couldn't state that, only with what was being told in the trial. And it goes on for the cycle. There's peace for a while and then it starts up again. And they do intimidate you to the point of being afraid to say anything. If they're standing there, you can't do anything. You can't call the police. You can't leave. And I knew he would not let me leave anyways unless he was asleep. And I did leave at least five times before, but I always came back because he threatened me, either through threatening me by saying that he would kill me if I left again. He put padlocks on the front and back door when we were living in Mill City, so I could not get into the house to get my things. He threatened to leave and take the kids to where I would never see them again, so I just let it right until the right time came, until something just snapped in me and said, I've had enough. And he is currently now serving 21 and a half years in prison for the different crimes he did to me. And this bill needs to be in effect because it would show that it's out of pure meanness and not because their minds aren't right.
Is there any questions by the committee of either of these witnesses? Thank you very much for coming forward today. Next, Bill Hauser, OCDLA, and if you want to come forward.
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association does oppose this piece of legislation. When we take a look at the idea of propensity crime, particularly character evidence propensity crime, that being because you are a bad guy, you are a bad guy in this situation that you're on trial for, we find that to be a situation in which a person is not being tried on the facts of the case that is before the court at that time. In State versus Johns, Justice Jones made an observation, and I don't generally try to read very often in front of the committee because I don't do it very well, frankly, but I'm going to in this sense, and he said, perhaps litigation over the admissibility of other crimes, wrongs, or acts, evidence could be reduced if litigators and judges would follow the preachings of Coach Vince Lombardi to his players to return to the basics. Trial judges should return to the basic reasons for the inadmissibility of crimes, wrongs, or acts, which are, number one, such evidence is often irrelevant to prove the conduct in question. Two, the common law and its codification forbids the attempt to prove a defendant guilty by proving that the defendant is a bad person or has bad character because of a disposition or propensity for committing crimes, wrongs, or other bad acts. And three, even if evidence that a defendant has committed other crimes or has some legitimate probative value, the danger of unfair prejudice to the defendant may outweigh any such probative value. Chair Williams, when we get into propensity evidence, what we're talking about is information that's going to be presented to the trier of fact that does not go to any material element of the charge. Propensity evidence is the evidence that a person is a bad person, that they are a violent person maybe in a domestic violence situation. And yet that's not one of the elements of a domestic violence case. The domestic violence case is that a person, for example, an assault case would cause physical injury to another person, intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, or with criminal negligence, or in a harassment case, it has particular elements. But the fact that a person has bad character, has a propensity maybe even to commit violence, or is a violent person, is not a material element. So what you're getting in is you're getting evidence, which any information presented to a trier of fact is evidence, that is not relevant to the material elements of the charge. Now, when we talk about, in this particular piece of legislation, the idea of a balancing test, whether the probative value of any evidence presented to the trier of fact is outweighed by prejudicial effect. That's exactly what we're talking about here. Because if it's not relevant to a material element of the offense, it is not probative to any material element of the offense. And so you have zero probative value, and yet the reason why people want to have this introduced is because it's extremely prejudicial to the idea of a fair trial. At that point, even under the language of this piece of legislation, you have a piece of evidence, propensity evidence, that basically should not be admitted, even under the terms of this legislation, because there is no probative value and it is extremely prejudicial. The idea that the state would want to gain convictions by using this type of prejudicial, non-probative evidence, frankly, in our position, or in our belief, is just the police power of the state gone out of control. Unless you believe that the state is always right in its charging practices, if they're always right in deciding that a person is guilty of a crime, if they're always right in using that police power, then this would be perfectly fine because they're always right. We as an organization don't believe that. And we were asking you not to look at this piece of legislation. Remember exactly what it is as far as how it affects the day-to-day workings of our criminal justice system and not pass it on. I might also indicate that this piece of legislation does not include just convictions but also prior acts that are not litigated. And so in every case, as a practical matter, you're going to have, if there's this indication that there's a want to use this kind of evidence, there's going to have to be some kind of pretrial hearing to determine the basic facts of that particular case and whether it's going to be used. So it's going to add costs to the criminal prosecution as well. But as the basic philosophy behind it, we are opposed to. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly.
Well, I have to say in this case, I think I agree with Mr. Hauser. Representative Doyle, in his presentation of this bill, referred to the current evidence code and the rule against probative evidence, the admissibility of probative evidence, as an oversight. I think that was his word. And in fact, I think as reflected in Justice Jones' comments, that's not an oversight. That's been a fundamental element of due process and the criminal law for centuries, that we convict people on the basis of facts as applied to a particular case and not just an array of facts over a period of time that tend to prove that the defendant is a bad actor and should go to jail anyway, even if the facts of this particular charge can't be proven. And I think we need to be extremely cautious as we look to go down that road in terms of what we are doing to due process and fundamental constitutional rights. And I admit this is one of those areas where the Constitution kind of gets in the way of sometimes where we would like to go, but I think we need to respect those constitutional limitations. Domestic violence is certainly one of the most difficult areas, and it's hard to turn away from that. But we know that burglary, for instance, is another crime in which usually if you've caught somebody, they've got a long record of prior burglaries Will we be looking at propensity evidence to convict burglars next? Where does it stop once we go this direction? And I think this is a line that, again, centuries of history has established is a line that we don't want to cross, and frankly, I'm not ready to.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with what the good representative from Lane, from Dallas.
You blew it.
I agree with Lane. What if we were to define domestic violence as including, or you know, one of the categories of domestic violence included a pattern of torture, pattern of abuse? Would that change your perspective about whether or not such patterns of behavior would be appropriate to evidence?
Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, that's an interesting question. It seems at least that if you were to change the definition of the law, that crime itself, to include some kind of pattern, then certainly pattern evidence would be relevant to that particular element. I'm not so sure whether that's such a good idea, but and I'd have to think about it a little bit more, but certainly that would get around the issue of relevance. I think that as far as our history and our Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, we've not done that, at least as I sit here answering your question, I can't think of something where we've got into pattern type of criminal behavior. And so I would be reluctant to sit here today and say, you know, that's something that is a positive thing to do.
I've had some experience in dealing with crimes of this nature also, and I have been astonished by the fact that it truly is a pattern. There seems to be an accelerating cycle of intimidation and then reconciliation and the whole damage that's done to the victim results, I think, more because of the continuing pattern than because of any one single incident. As it wears you down so thoroughly. Maybe that's something we ought to explore some time or during the interim.
You wanted to respond.
Well, Chair Williams, Representative Lowe, and I think that shows that we're not just talking about something that belongs within the criminal justice system, but also there's a sociological issue here that we're not going to address through the criminal justice system, and we can't forget that. This is not a one-dimensional thing.
Representative Dean Philbin.
I do also struggle with this. I served as a board member for the Portland Women's Crisis Line for a couple of years and actually went through all the training to be a crisis intervention person staffed a crisis line and worked on safe harbor for domestic violence victims. And what I struggle with here, and I appreciate Representative Shetterly's analogy with burglary being recurring, but this is often times where we're looking at endangerment of women's lives, and so if there's any way we can look at a pattern, seeing that domestic violence often is not a one-time event, but it's often repeat offenders that either, as we heard today, the victims are too afraid to even come and talk to the police about without undue restriction on, you know, individuals' rights. I think this is the part where, again, we struggle over and over with, and if there's any way to look at somehow a pattern, because I don't, you know, this happens again and again and again, and I've seen this, you know, particular instance where previous incidents of domestic violence aren't considered in court cases. So I appreciate where you're coming from, but I also do believe that this is an issue that we need to look at very hard.
And Representative Krieger.
Chair Williams, Mr. Hauser, you've heard the discussion about patterns. There's also a pattern that develops in children who come out of those domestic violence and how they bring that forward and live that same lifestyle. Can you address that?
Chair Williams, Representative Krieger, yeah, I believe that does occur. It goes from generation to generation, and I don't think that again is one of those issues that it's going to be very difficult to deal with within the criminal law. There are two phases to any prosecution, but domestic violence prosecution particularly, and one is, can the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt? And then if they do that, what's going to happen to the perpetrator? And when we get past that first stage of can the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, and we get to what's going to happen, that is where the prior instances of domestic violence would be put before the sentencing the judge, so that the judge can determine what might be an appropriate way to deal with the problem. Now, obviously, that does not take into consideration the fact that sometimes it's very difficult as a prosecutor to prove domestic violence cases because victims are simply not willing to go forward with it. And between 88 and 92, I happened to be a district court prosecutor in Yamhill County, and one of my jobs was the domestic violence prosecution of cases. And certainly I felt the frustration while I was prosecuting how to do that with people who would make the report to the police of domestic violence. And, of course, we would go through the process of making sure that the person was arrested and charged, and then they would come back, the victim would come back sometime later and say that they just didn't want to go forward with it, and they would not cooperate with the prosecution of the cases. I know that as a prosecutor then I attempted to prosecute those cases without the victim and using things like excited utterance exceptions and things like that to prove cases. When those cases, I know that my office at that time was very interested in making sure that that cycle of violence was broken, and so we offered other types of alternative resolutions to people charged with that type of crime so that they could potentially go through some kind of intervention, whether it be counseling, that type of thing, in order to hopefully break that cycle of violence. That might be another way to look at domestic violence and another way to break the cycle. Now, again, that goes really sort of outside the criminal justice system because we're dealing with more than just a criminal justice problem. Certainly it is a criminal justice problem, but it is a family problem, it is a social problem. There's a lot of other areas that we need to deal with under those kind of situations.
Representative Wall.
Thank you. Well, apparently in this case, this inability to bring forward pattern evidence did not impair the prosecution because the gentleman is serving 21 years in prison, which is probably, I congratulate the prosecutor, probably a record sentence for domestic violence in the state of Oregon. So she was able to accomplish it, notwithstanding the frustration she had in the evidence code.
Bill, the one comment you made that's a little troubling to me about the bill, and I share and appreciate the reservations of Representative Shetterly on some of the issues, and I think the bill could be wordsmithed to make it a little more balanced in the way this evidence might be handled. But you suggested at one point, I think you said that this information of these actions has no probative value. And I'm not sure I agree with you with that. I recognize that it has substantial prejudicial value, and you and I both know in trying lawsuits that the only reason you put evidence in a case is because you're looking for its prejudicial effect against the person you're trying the suit on. Were it not prejudicial, you wouldn't want the evidence in the first place. I mean, you're trying to make your case. So I recognize the need to balance it, but to suggest that the fact that a person has supportable evidence, and I have my own concerns about, claims that were never made or cases that were never adjudicated and those being used, but to the extent that there are witnesses who can testify of prior acts of domestic abuse, and they can do that balanced against, the court's own requirement to strike that balance, I think it's one thing for us to all sit around here and legally say that there's no probative evidence to suggest that, the guy who beat his wife substantially for a 15-year period of time, that doesn't have any impact on the probativeness of whether or not he hit her this time. And we can legally say that, but most people understand that the odds are that if he's been beating her for 15 years and there's evidence of that in effect, or in this case, I think you couldn't even go 15. There's a 10-year limit bar with some hurdles that would have to be overcome.
does have a probative impact on whether or not, you know, it is more likely to have occurred in this case. So I guess I'm a little troubled by the comment that you don't think it has any probative value. That being said, I share some of the very same concerns, and I think the challenge would be for us to strike language that would create this balance. And there are some words in the bill that I'm not completely satisfied with that we could talk about. But it's a conversation that I'm not quite yet willing to just entirely give up on, and one I'd like to engage in further. Representative Ackerman, did you have a question?
Yes, I just had a couple of comments. I think the bill as drafted is too broad. I think the statement of the existing law is correct, that if you can get this evidence into the court to establish motive, state of mind, and opportunity of the defendant, that is a very, very powerful prosecution tool, because they get the evidence in anyway. And to be able to argue that to a jury, I think, is most persuasive. I had one experience which my client was wrongfully accused of domestic abuse and had to stand trial on assault 4, where his wife, who was the alleged victim, recanted her testimony, and that recantation was documented by email and letters she had written. And the overzealous prosecutor went ahead anyway, excused the victim from the trial, and again tried to prove the case on character evidence and hearsay. I guess it's a